Technology, it's such a big part of our lives. It can be fun, it can be convenient, just like this podcast, which is why University of Missouri Healthcare is proud to support podcasting on KBIA. Technology can also save your life. That's why so many people turn to University of Missouri Healthcare. Its hospitals and clinics offer you the latest technology, plus a medical team whose skill and knowledge are unparalleled. You know technology makes everyday life a lot better. Well, it's true for your healthcare, too. University of Missouri Healthcare, the care you deserve from the team you trust.
Hello, and welcome to Under the Microscope, KBIA's weekly look into stories in science, health, and technology. I'm Raymond Tungekar. On today's show, we'll hear how some farmers are using hydroponics technology to save on water, and revisit an interview with biologist Edward O. Wilson. Much of the country has been cracked open by heat and drought this year, and farmers are feeling the pinch of low crop yields and battles over water rights. But what if there were a way to grow crops using, say, 90% less water? Enter hydroponics technology. Sounds like magic, but while it's gaining in popularity, it has a long way to go before it can start working agricultural miracles. Hilary Stose Krause has more in this report for Harvest Public Media.
Marv Fritz runs a 24-acre greenhouse in O'Neill, Nebraska, in the north-central part of the state. In the middle of summer, the 7-year-old greenhouse produces about 250,000 pounds of tomatoes a week.
And about mid-November.
In a summer of record heat across the Midwest, Fritz says the greenhouse, run by local company Garden Fresh Vegetables, uses very little water.
We probably use 2 or 3% of the water that a corn crop would use covering the same acreage.
It's more than just the greenhouse making the difference. The real game changer here is hydroponics technology. Essentially, hydroponics involves growing plants without dirt. Instead of receiving nutrients from soil or fertilizer, the plants receive nutrients from water solutions that drip directly into the root system. Hydroponic technology has been around since the 1920s, but researchers say it's only really started to take off in the last decade or so. According to a report from IBIS World, a market research company, the annual growth of the U.S. hydroponic crop industry for each of the last 5 years was around 8%. Across the Midwest, farms are hoping to take advantage of renewed interest in hydroponics. Take Elm Lane Farm, for example, which grows hydroponic lettuce. The small farm, located just outside of Wichita, Kansas, is pretty new. In fact, they just harvested their first crop at the end of June. Karen Hull and her husband Mike built their greenhouse in April.
Right now, we're still in the learning curve portion of it, but are enjoying watching the lettuce grow and learning how to deal with the various issues that come up.
The Hulls, along with other proponents of hydroponics, point out that growing in a controlled environment can eliminate the need for pesticides or chemicals. Also, greenhouses don't take up much space, and plants can be grown year-round. But the real draw is that decreased water use. Peter Ling specializes in controlled environment agriculture at Ohio State University. He says lettuce grown in a field uses about 10 to 30 gallons of water per head, while lettuce grown in a controlled environment, such as hydroponics, requires only 1 to 2 gallons per head. That's at least 80% less water. Still, despite the technology's increasing popularity, Ling says we can't expect to see hydroponics eclipsing field production anytime soon.
For a field crop farmer to go into the hydroponics, and there's a lot of new concepts that need to be adopted, technology need to be learned. The main thing is the cost, investment, and technology involved.
But isn't farmland really expensive right now, too? A good irrigated ground in central Nebraska costs $5,000 to $6,000 per acre, according to the Kansas City Federal Reserve. Marv Fritz says that's small beans compared to a large hydroponic system like the one in O'Neill. He estimates that the cost of a new greenhouse would run around $500,000 per acre. The costs are worth it for certain premium crops, like tomatoes, cucumbers, lettuce, and peppers. Some are even experimenting with growing livestock feed hydroponically. For now, hydroponics remains active in mostly a niche market. And Marv Fritz doesn't see that changing anytime soon, simply because of the cost of investment and the availability of farmland.
In Kansas, and probably the Midwest in general, it's such a dirt-based agriculture with the wheat and corn and soybeans. I just think it's a matter of education, that as people become more familiar with the products that are grown, that it'll hopefully become more widespread.
Karen Hull, the Kansas farmer, agrees and says there's still a lot to learn about hydroponics.
As long as we have plenty of land in this country, it's going to be tough, and that's why you see that type of production, say in Holland or in China, Korea. They have very, very little arable land and a lot of people.
And if drought continues to be an issue, and if the costs of the technology associated with hydroponics continue to decrease, more and more operations might look into ditching their soil and trying something new. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Hilary Stose-Krause.
Biologist Edward O. Wilson is an emeritus university research professor at Harvard. Through his lifelong research on the behavior of ants, he's transformed the disciplines of ecology and evolutionary biology, developing new theories and pioneering the field of sociobiology. Wilson was in St. Louis earlier this year to deliver the keynote address at a University of Missouri St. Louis conference. He spoke to St. Louis Public Radio's Veronique LaCapra and told her that his long and successful career started with a childhood fascination with bugs.
I began when I was about 9 years old catching butterflies and gathering all sorts of insects in Washington, D.C.'s Rock Creek Park, and never looked back. I decided I was going to be an entomologist, and I did. I had a snake period. I had a frog period growing up in Alabama, but then I returned to the insects and the ants, and I never left.
Now, you've won two Pulitzer Prizes, and one is actually for a large format, more than 600-page, I think, book all about ants. Why ants? What made you want to write such a comprehensive work about an insect that probably a lot of people don't even notice or at best think is a nuisance?
They most emphatically, and let me repeat, most emphatically should notice, because ants are the dominant insects of the world. They make up something like 3/4 of all of the biomass of all the insects. And they dominate the environments that they're in, the land environments.
What's in a 600-page-plus book about ants?
Everything. It is the reference work you want to use if you want to find out anything about ants, at least known to 1988. And most of that information is still solid. I mean, has not been superseded.
You also pioneered the field of sociobiology. What is that, and why is it significant?
Sociobiology is the scientific study of the biological foundation of all forms of social behavior in all kinds of organisms. And I put that together in the late 60s as part of a review of all the social insects I did. Before we did the ants, I did another monster book called The Insect Societies that dealt with that. And then in 1975, a third monster book called Sociobiology, The New Synthesis, in which I put together just about everything we knew about the evolution and nature of societies. And sociobiology is now much accepted mainstream discipline of biology.
And that's it for this week's Under the Microscope. To listen to this episode and others, just head to our website, kbia.org.